I first met today's guest, Vandana Shiva, in Seattle in 1999, where she was one of the leaders of the International Forum on Globalization and its teach-ins and protests against the WTO. Well, we all know much has happened since that historic week. Sadly, most of it bearing out the warnings then given about the wrong directions we were being led by multinational corporations and their dominance of governments in the headlong rush to corporate globalization. Today we face multiple and interconnected crises in the arenas of energy, environment, equity, finance, and food. And for those taking the long view, these crises also offer opportunities. I'll be asking Dr. Shiva about the world's food and agriculture systems. Are they broken? And if so, how? How did they get that way? And most importantly, how do we fix them? Dr. Vandana Shiva is a physicist, ecologist, activist, feminist, editor, and author of many books. In India, she's established Navdanya, a movement for biodiversity conservation and farmers' rights. She also directs the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Natural Resource Policy. Her books include Biopiracy, The Plunder of Nature and Knowledge, Stolen Harvest, The Hijacking of the Global Food Supply, and her newest, Soil, Not Oil, Environmental Justice in an Age of Climate Crisis. Welcome, Vandana Shiva.
Hello, Terence.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. Now, you started out as a physicist, so just tell us a bit about your path to the work that you focus on today.
Well, I trained as a quantum physicist and did my doctorate in aspects of quantum theory that I think should be the basis of thinking today, not the 100-year-old outmoded reductionist and mechanistic paradigm that classical mechanics gave us. Quantum theory tells us everything is connected, nothing separable. Quantum theory tells us nothing is determinate. Everything has a potential. And those are the concepts we should be working with. But we have in agriculture the worst of an outmoded mechanistic idea of how the world works.
Okay, so a very natural progression for you, and it makes very good sense to me. Okay, I hinted at this before we got on the air, but I think basically I've got three big questions. And this is about the food and agricultural system that we now deal with in the entire world. How is it broken? What's the evidence that it's broken? How can we tell? What are the indicators? Then how did it get broken? What are the causes, the history, the culprits? Finally, how do we fix it? And that's the most important. How do we fix it? What are the solutions and what can listeners do? So first, Dr. Shiva, is the world agriculture and food system broken? And if so, how?
Yes, the food and agriculture system is broken ecologically, and it's broken socially, it's broken ethically. Food, after all, is the very basis of sustenance. Everyone has a right to food, and yet this right is being violated by the intrinsic structures of the way the agriculture system runs today and the food system runs today. The evidence of it being broken lies in 1 billion people not getting access to food. Now, most of the billion that are starving today are people who could be producing food for themselves, but the method of growing food takes the food away from them. At the social level, it's clearly broken when farmers aren't able to produce food. The most primary of all human economic activities, the production of food, has been rendered unviable to such an extent by the distortions of the way the market work, the way the production systems work, the way the technological systems work. We have farmers being pulled off the land everywhere. And that means the social base of production of food is being crushed. Ecologically, the food and agriculture system is broken. The evidence is in the fact that most of the farm soils of the world are today desertified. We've destroyed the nutrients. The biodiversity base has shrunk. We used to eat 8,500 crops. We today trade in 8. Water, mining, the maximum amount of water abuse is done for industrial farming systems. More than 10 times more water is used for industrial agriculture than in ecological systems. And finally, the breaking of the ecological cycles is also evidenced in the climate crisis, the issues I've addressed in my book, Soil, Not Oil, the rupturing of the nitrogen cycles, carbon cycles, industrial agriculture has a huge role in that. So, every level of the food system, today it is fragmented, it's broken, and the only place where it seems to be working for a short while is in the super profits of seed corporations, of which there are only five, the leading one being Monsanto, which used to be a chemical company, has no history in the business of dealing with living resources, dealing with agriculture. It was in the business of creating poisons to kill people, and it's turning agriculture into a business of killing people, as we see in the case of 200,000 farmer suicides in India. The other interests that are doing very well out of a broken food system are the agribusiness and trading giants like Cargill, ConAgra, and ADM. And thirdly, the food processing giants who transform food into something totally unedible, then change the laws to turn the hazardous food into safe food and create food safety laws to ban healthy food. I'm just traveling with farmers in the areas of Michigan where they're talking about how they can't sell fresh milk. Now, fresh milk is everybody's right. In India, we drink fresh milk. Freshness has been transformed into a danger, and toxics have been transformed into safety. So it's also broken in the way we think intellectually about how food grows and what food is.
Wow. Very, very, very succinct, very complete. Thank you. Let me ask you, I mean, what I love about it is we started out, you said it was the holistic nature of reality that you learned through quantum physics that led you to this. And your answer, of course, is that we are facing a break that is also holistic because all these systems, all these pathways of these systems are interconnected. When I was going to say, how did it happen? Let me ask you, you said that maybe a billion of these people who have little access to food now could grow their own 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. Now they cannot. Take us down to the case of a single farmer. Or a single village, how have they been taken or removed from their own ability to feed themselves and their family?
Well, many of the people who are going hungry today are actually even today growing food. But when you grow food with costly inputs, seeds that have to be bought every year, chemicals that cost the earth, you get into debt. And that debt has to be paid. So the harvest is no more yours. You have to sell the harvest. And the nature of the pricing in this distorted corporate-controlled agriculture is when food is bought from farmers, it's bought cheap. When it's sold to consumers, it is sold at 3, 4, 5 times the price. But a farmer is a farmer when he sells and a consumer when he eats, if he or she is selling the food to pay back the debts, in which case the farmer is ending up eating only about a quarter of what they could have eaten if they had entitlement to their food and their incomes had not been robbed by the chemical industry and the seed industry. The others who could be producing food but have been denied their access to food are the millions who have been displaced from the land as the hunger of a global economy, a global consumer economy, appropriates land for mines, for highways, for industries, for deforestation. In effect, food production capacity of those ecosystems is destroyed and the food production capacity of the local people is destroyed. The third category of people who could be producing food for themselves but are going hungry are the people whose incomes have been stolen by an unjust and unfair and unfree trading system, which we were fighting in Seattle. When we were saying WTO is an unfair institution with unfair rules, not all the data was on the table. Those of us who actually work in these situations knew. But the data is now on the table. For example, in India, in the major crops that are traded internationally, farmers have lost approximately $25 billion a year because of falling prices. And the fall in prices means they have less earnings and therefore they have less entitlement to food. The falling prices are caused by a combination of two factors. Each of these factors separately wouldn't be disastrous, but the combination is what makes for genocide. And the combination is agribusiness harvesting $400 billion as subsidies in the rich countries from taxpayers' money, and then forcing third world countries like India to open up their markets for these cheap, artificially cheap subsidized products to be dumped on us by removing our restrictions and protections from these unfair imports. So in cotton, the prices went down to a third. In oil seeds, the prices went down to a third. I remember the year farmers in Kerala protested. One coconut, which used to cost 10 rupees, dropped to 2 rupees. A farmer could not survive with that. And if you grow coconut, you're not just growing them for yourselves. You're growing coconuts so you can sell most of them, and then you can buy the rice that you need to eat and the dal that you need to eat. So a combination of these three things is preventing the producers of food from having access to food.
Very, very frightening and very clear what you say. Talk just a little bit more about how this happened. How the, in other words, the sort of the history that led us to 99 and now 2009, where these inequities in subsidies and so on have taken food from what was a, for billions, it was a simple thing. And for others, it was a big commercial, you know, industry. But now that industry has, as you clearly stated, been pushing the simple farmers, simple agriculture out of the way. How did they do it?
Well, the beginning actually goes back to the war industry, the chemical industry that made chemicals for warfare, finding out that they could now deploy them in agriculture. Nitrogen fertilizers came out of the explosive factories for the war and were put into agriculture after the wars. The introduction in the third world of these war chemicals was called the Green Revolution, which is neither green nor revolutionary. Its application, the first application and first experiment, was in the Indian Punjab. In 1984, the Indian Punjab was a land of extremism and terrorism and warfare. The Nobel Prize for Peace had been given on grounds that the Green Revolution would create peace. And instead, it left very angry and very discontented farmers who saw themselves as being turned into slaves, where they did not decide what was grown, how it was grown, and what price it would sell at. That's what started me off in my search of why had agriculture become so violent, unproductive? Why did it have to kill people in, innocent people in Bhopal? Why did it have to kill innocent people in Punjab? Unfortunately, in spite of the failure of the Green Revolution in Punjab, where it's the very beneficiaries who took arms and said, you have cheated us, today the Gates Foundation is pouring billions into spreading the Green Revolution in Africa through what is called the Alliance for the Green Revolution in Agra, in Africa, called Agra. And I often say, this Agra will not create a Taj Mahal, it will create more desertified soils, it will destroy indigenous biodiversity, and it will leave even more vulnerable peasants in Africa.
Tell just a little bit more about that. By that, I mean the evidence of the failures and inadequacy of the Green Revolution, it seems to me, are obvious. The Gates Foundation seems to be doing good work on malaria and other things. What's the disconnect here that propels this Agra?
Well, you'll have to ask the people who have a disconnect, because for me, it's a deep puzzle. It's a deep puzzle why, with all the evidence, with all the letters that have come from African leaders, African citizens, African farmers to the Gates Foundation to say, call this blunder off, they want to carry on. And I think it comes partly from arrogance. It comes partly from assuming the Africans are stupid, the third world is stupid. And it comes partly from a highly illusionary idea of what technology is. There's a very narrow idea of mechanistic technology that thinks technology is something you bring from outside. So when you bring a chemical from outside, then it's technology. If you do ecological recycling of biomass through organic composting, that's not seen as technology, even though it's a more sophisticated technology, because the organic farmer needs to know more about the soil and how to compost. He needs to know nothing about how to spray urea on a plot of land.
Right.
So, in fact, the higher intelligence is embodied in the ecological alternative. Again, when a tractor is brought into a land, it is seen as technology, but when a sustainable, renewable animal energy plow is plowing your land, it's not seen as technology. So a fossilized idea of technology, what else can I call it?
Yes.
Fossilized because it's driven from the fossil fuel idea of machines and synthetic chemicals. That was defined as technology at the beginning of the industrial era, and it continues to be defined as technology, even though today, in 2009, with climate change, with water scarcity, with biodiversity erosion, with the public health epidemic of playing with chemicals and putting war poisons into our food as pesticides, Today we need to be redefining technology into technologies that work with nature, soft technologies, nonviolent technologies. And I think there's this idea of this fossilized idea of what a technology is in farming. Probably that comes from it.
That makes good sense to me. And so, you know, one thing that I was thinking of as you were speaking was, before her death, I interviewed Dana Meadows.
Yes.
And she was, of course, a systems theorist. And I remember she said, you know, it's not that that we're really stupid. She said, human beings usually figure out the mistakes they've made, but the overshoot of the time it takes to correct their errors, you know, is what may doom us. You know, she said there's this lag time between the time that a correct idea or a correction can get to the consciousness, get through the politics, get through the lobbyists and so on to actually take effect. And so when you're speaking about a fossilized view of agriculture and technology, you know, I wonder if there isn't something of that going on. And that now let's shift it, if we can, to this thing of what, how do we fix this? Do you agree with what I said at the top, that that actually these crises, in some sense, offer us opportunities because they call into question business as usual? Does this interdependent set of crises also offer us opportunities?
I think it offers us huge opportunities to the extent that, A, we can see the interdependence of the crises. We don't see them separately. We don't see a banking crisis and then try and bail out the banks. We don't see just a peak oil crisis and then grab the land and the food of the poor and put it into our fuel tanks as biofuels. Seeing the crisis separately will aggravate the problem and not find a solution. It'll create false solutions. Seeing them as interdependent and therefore seeing the need for a paradigm shift provides the huge opportunity, humanity hasn't had for as long as history goes. The first is the financial crisis. The current food system was built on the assumption you can keep increasing costs of production. Farmers can keep getting credit to buy more costly seeds, genetically modified seeds, continuing to pay royalties to the Monsantos out of their scarce incomes, and things will carry on. The credit crunch tells us that that model will not work. We've got to lower the cost of production. Lowering the cost of production means shifting to an agriculture where most of your inputs come from the farm. The seed is farmer's seed. The compost comes from the farm. Pest control is part of the way you manage the farm. And water is part of what you conserve on your land. You can increase water conservation tenfold by the right kind of organic farming. The second, peak oil. Now, peak oil basically means oil resources are running out. But that doesn't mean energy sources are running out. And we need to make a shift early enough to renewables in order to be able to phase out the fossil fuels. Among the fossil fuel-based inputs that is critical in agriculture is fertilizer. It starts from fossil fuels and it emits nitrogen oxides, one of the most lethal greenhouse gases. You don't need chemical fertilizers, and that's why the Gates Foundation is wrong in putting that as its priority for Africa. What is needed is a compost in every backyard. What is needed is ecological farming, which the International Agricultural Assessment on Science and Technology by 400 scientists under the United Nations has shown, small-scale ecological farming is the most productive, highest returns, and most reliable food security. And it's time the Gates Foundation officials read those United Nations reports. The third crisis is the crisis of food entitlements. Now, you can never have food entitlements for the poor based on market delivery, but you cannot also have it based on market delivery through public systems, because it is assumed that when a World Food Program gives food to the poor, it's giving charity. No, the World Food Program is actually a market for Cargill. It's a market for Monsanto's genetically modified corn and soya. This is not charity. It's a market exercise done through public institutions. And this is being taken to the last level, where hunger has become the biggest market. The same corporations that have created malnutrition and hunger are now in line through a global alliance for improved nutrition, also led by the Gates Foundation. And on it are the McDonald's and the Coca-Colas and the Pepsis and the Nestle's and the Monsantos and the Dow's and the DuPonts. Every one who has destroyed our food system, is now trying to sell food to governments for the severely malnourished. The poorest of the poor children has become the biggest market for genetically engineered rice for vitamin A, another hazard, for totally synthetic iron when we have the best of biodiversity to provide vitamin A and iron to people. So we are going to see the industrialization of food have yet another attempt at making profits at the cost of people's lives.
So in other words, in the question I asked about how does this crisis offer an opportunity, in other words, they see an opportunity in this crisis as well.
Absolutely. If you looked at the World Food Summit last year, which was on the food crisis and the climate crisis, they were in line. That's where GAIN and all of these things and Agra were being sold. They were looking at the crisis they've created as their next opportunity. For people, the opportunity is to take back the seed, to take back food. And I think one of the most revolutionary things happening is how everywhere in the world, people are recognizing that in the soil is the highest potential for livelihoods, in the soil is the highest potential for providing good food, and in the soil is the highest potential of our relinking to the earth. The soil provides food security because the soil is everywhere, the sun is everywhere, and that decentralized system is the real opportunity. The false opportunity in the hands of five seed giants, five agri-trade giants, and five or six food processing giants is not an opportunity for people. It will deepen the crisis, fragment the crisis, break the food system even further, and deepen the crisis of malnutrition. I believe everywhere in the world there are movements for food democracy and food sovereignty, and all of it is captured in three simple words.
Very good.
Biodiversity, bring back biodiversity away from monocultures, ecological, not industrial farming based on chemicals, and localized rather than globalized food distribution.
Right. Now, this sense of localization, which, of course, you hear it in America from many, from Michael Pollan, from Bill McKibben, and so on, or from not just about food, but also about energy. And it turns out also, if people look, local banks, of which it's hard to find them in a city like Los Angeles, local banks are doing fine. Credit unions are doing fine. They didn't get involved in the global casino. This idea of local decentralized energy, local decentralized finance, local decentralized agriculture and food distribution is what will save us and feed us. What are you doing in India?
Well, you know, the globalized system's most dramatic impact in India is, for example, in cotton. When Monsanto brought in genetically engineered cotton seeds, farmers got into deep debt. And then the subsidies of $4 billion in the U.S. led to cotton dumping, driving down the price of what the farmers had grown. The combination of falling prices, rising costs led farmers to suicide, 200,000 farmer suicides in India, most of them concentrated in the BT cotton area. What we are doing is creating ecological farming in these areas, distributing seeds of hope, and creating fibers of freedom. It is possible to do agriculture without killing farmers. It's possible to do agriculture without killing the soil. And as you said, it's the areas where seed is still in farmers' hands that we don't have a crisis. Where there's organic farming, there are no farm suicides. Where there is local food distribution, there is no hunger. Hunger is the creation of the globalized industrialized food system. Farmer suicides are a creation of this globalized food system. So localization, including in the economic transactions between people,
exactly,
in terms of local economy, and in the social relations between people, which is why we say when we do organic farming, we're not just growing good food, we are growing good community.
Right. Well, as one of the little simple indicators is people who go to a farmer's market versus people who go to a supermarket, people who go to a farmer's market engage in conversations at a much higher level. They develop relationships, which is, does not happen in a supermarket. If I gave you 1 minute, what should listeners do in terms of both learning and acting?
I think that the place where we can all act to create a security in a time of deep insecurity, you know, a sustenance in time of total collapse, the place to begin is food. And if you're in the city, find a farmer's market. If it doesn't exist, build it. Find the local growers, the organic growers in your neighborhood. Find the farmers in 100 miles of your base. And take 3 years to totally build a local food economy. To do that, create new currencies, create new transactions. Barter is doubling in this country as the financial economy crashes and as jobs are lost. But money is not the real currency of life. Social relationships, compassion, solidarity, and life itself is the real currency of life. So let's enhance the currency of life while the false currency of Wall Street collapses in front of our eyes.
Wonderful. Thank you. So again, the book is Soil Not Oil, Environmental Justice in an Age of Climate Crisis. The websites are Navdanya, that's Navdanya, navdanya.org, and Vandana Shiva, one word, .com. Thank you, Vandana Shiva. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Terrence.
Very well. Bye-bye.